Well, very warm welcome this evening to the Museum of the History of Science. Lucky you who got in. We've just sent away a large group of people who are queuing outside. We're too late for this very special event. I'm Silke Hackerman, I'm the director of the museum, and we are particularly pleased tonight to have Alex Halliday with us. There's hardly any speaker who I can imagine more suited for our current topic, our display topic upstairs, Moonstruck. Alex Halliday is a professor here in Oxford. He's the head of the Mathematics, Physics and Life Sciences Division. He's also, since December, the physical secretary, that's the vice president of the Royal Society. How he manages to juggle all of that, I have no idea. I feel like a complete failure. But in any case, Alex specializes on isotope geochemistry, and which enables him to tell us all about lots of things, but amongst other things, the age of the moon and where the moon came from. So over to you, Alex.
Thank you very much, Sophie. So thanks all of you for coming. This is such a special environment. It's wonderful, and I feel really honoured to be here. Even though I've been in Oxford for 10 years, this is a really, really great place. I'm going to try and take you through some of the recent arguments about the origin of the moon. Some of it's a bit technical, and if you want to interrupt and say, look, can you explain that, I'll have a go. But some of it may, just to get through the talk in 50 minutes, I'll probably have to skip over one or two bits of detail. So forgive me. And if it gets, it'll probably get more and more technical as time goes on, just a warning. So this is one of my favourite photographs of the moon. It's a beautiful picture of an eclipse, which basically shows the moon and the sun. It's nice because it shows the way the sun, the moon, our atmosphere and the Earth are all connected, including the life that we've got going on here. And Andy Flipper, let me use that one. So the moon has been an issue for quite a while, and this is Othello, who was complaining about the fact that the moon was driving people crazy, and actually the same is true today with scientists, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. We'll come back to Othello, and this particular aspect that she comes more near the Earth than she was wont is actually exactly true of the way the Earth and the Moon are related in their composition. This is one of the more recent shots of the Moon from a Japanese mission a few years ago. It's a beautiful shot looking at the Earth. And there are some very distinctive features. Can you see that at the very back? I don't know if you can see that writing, Christine. the largest, I was expecting this to be a smaller audience. So. Basically, one of the things that people don't realise is the moon, actually, we think of moons as being quite normal things, but our moon is the largest moon in the solar system relative to the size of its host planet. And that might mean it's had a rather special origin, and in some ways that's what comes out of the simulations. It also has a lower density than Earth. So these are things we already knew before we ever went to the moon. It's been very obvious that its density was a bit lower by about 30%. And that probably means it almost certainly means it's got a smaller iron core. So we've got an iron core that makes up about a third of the mass of the Earth. The moon's core is vanishingly small by comparison. The other thing we know very well is that the moon spins around the Earth. And we know that the Earth basically rotates on its axis, and the moon basically goes around in the same direction, and the two are very closely linked. Some of you may have heard a term called angular momentum, which we use in physics. It's basically about the forces driving an object around another object, and the angular momentum of the Earth-Moon system, most of that angular momentum is actually in the moon, going around the Earth. And these are all features that need to be explained by any model for how the moon formed. Now, of course, in the late 60s, we went to the moon and actually got rocks back, and a lot of people talked about what a great technical mission it was, what a great technical achievement it was to go to the moon, and of course it was a great achievement from the point of view of politics and security, as far as the Americans were concerned. But probably the most important thing has often been missed out in the discussions, and that is that we brought rocks back. That wasn't the original intent at all. In fact, scientists in America had to plead with the president and everybody else to get NASA to actually agree to bring some samples back. They weren't going to bring anything back. It was to go there, plant the flag, and come back. And it was an amazing thing. Actually, eventually, if enough distinguished people managed to persuade them to actually pick up some stuff and bring it back with them. So, of course, there were all kinds of quarantine issues around doing that for the first time. But the archive of material that's been accumulated from all those Apollo missions has been phenomenally important. And we wouldn't know there was a problem with the origin of the moon and our understanding of it unless we had those samples. So sample return is one of the most important parts of missions that we have to consider all the time. So one of the things we found out about after we'd been out to the moon and brought some rocks back is that the white parts of the moon here, the highlands, which actually are made up largely of this rock that we call anorthosite. It's a white-coloured rock. This is a sample 60025 from Apollo 16, which was brought back. It's one of the best samples we've got from the highlands. And these rocks are actually up to 4.5 billion years old, so they're pretty much as old as the solar system. So that means that crust that you've got, this white crust that makes up most of the moon, is very, very early. It's a very primordial feature. We don't have anything like this left on Earth at all. The first 500 million years of the Earth's history is pretty much wiped out for reasons that we conjecture as to may have something to do with early bombardment of the Earth's surface. But we still got the crust there. It's very, very ancient. The dark bits, which you can see at night, the maria, these are younger. They're made up of basalt, rather like Hawaiian basalt. And those are up to, those are 3 billion years or older. Nothing much really has happened since about 3 billion years ago. So unlike on Earth, where you can be going to university one day and just happens to have a volcano going off in the background, and you don't really notice it's happening, this kind of thing doesn't happen on the moon. On the moon, everything's quiet and dead, and nothing much has happened for 3 billion years. And similarly, if you look from space down at the Gulf of California here, this is Baja California seen from the space shuttle, you've got this big unzipping going on. There's huge tectonic processes pulling America and the rest of the globe apart, the surface of the Earth apart, and in 50 million years' time, Baja California will have unzipped from the side of California. It'll be up here next to Alaska, which is a major problem, particularly for real estate. The government of California is very concerned about it. So these things don't happen on the moon. Everything's been pretty much static for the last 3 billion years. There's a little bit happening, but not very much. Now, to understand how the moon formed, we need to actually take a look at how planets form, and more generally. And I just want to quickly take you from way out to beyond our own solar system to the constellation of Orion, where we've actually got some of the most exciting evidence for how planets form. And I want to take a quick look at that first, because that ties into some of the other things that we see going on. So this is the constellation of Orion. This is Orion's belt in here. And just down here, there's what's called a nebula, the Orion Nebula, which is M42, for those of you who are astrophysicists. This is a close-up of M42. It's a beautiful, and we're going to zoom into this bit here, but the slide is going to go upside down. And just inside here, you can start to see appearing a little trapezium of four stars in there, very, very bright objects. You can zoom in on those a bit more closely. You can see them there. And as you get closer, you can actually start to see those. There's these other things just in here, which are kind of dusty objects, which aren't very clear. And if you get really close to those, what you discover is that these are brand new stars just forming. And the reason why you can't see them very clearly is they're surrounded by disks of dust. And sometimes you see those edge on, so they look like this. So the actual central star is pretty much obscured by all that dust. And sometimes you see it side on like that. But these dusty disks are what we've been theorizing since Laplace and Kant and people like that proposed that our solar system formed from a disk. And that now we can actually see these things, and we can actually take a look at how long they survive for, and we can come up with ideas for what's happening. Because if we think the planets were made from dust like this, then the lifetime of the dust tells you how quickly you built the planets. And people have plotted that up. There's a paper that came out a few years ago where they looked at lots and lots of stars about the size of our own star, our own sun, in one of these environments. And they plotted the number that had disks versus how old those stars are. They have ways of figuring out the age of the stars, which I won't go into. But basically what you can see is that the numbers that have disks, or the fraction that have disks, decreases quite dramatically as the star gets older. And stars that are actually more than 5 million years old, or 10 million years old, there's hardly any that have any with disks. So that gives us an idea that these disks don't last long. They're a feature of very, very young stars, and that means you're building planets roughly on that time scale, taking all that dust and turning them into planets. Now, we've got our own disk that made the solar system, and we've actually got samples from that original dusty disk. And people don't realise that, but you've got them in your meteorite collections, we've got them in our Museum of Natural History here, and we've got them in all museums of natural history just about. These are meteorites called chondrites. They're very primitive. These things never made it to form planets. They're just debris piles of stuff that accumulated into very, very small planetesimals, as we call them, which may have been a few kilometres in size, but not very big. And of course, debris from these chondrites lands on Earth as shooting stars. Those of you may not realise that we get about 50 million kilograms of stuff landing on the Earth every year from outer space, and most of it's very, very fine dust, but if you add it up, it comes up to about 50,000 tonnes. Now, most of those meteorites that land on Earth are these things we call chondrites. Don't need to worry about the details of these, but you won't find rocks like this forming on Earth. They're completely different from things you get in volcanoes. They're jungled up sources that look more like sedimentary rocks, you know, bits of stuff that's just been dumped on top of each other. And some of the bits and pieces that are actually in there are very, very interesting. If you dissolve one of these things up and analyse it, you find the composition is almost exactly the same as the Sun, except that we don't have all the hydrogen and helium. There's much, much less of that. So they're thought to represent the most primitive material in the solar system, and they're probably the stuff from which the Earth and other planets were made, the rocky stuff from which the terrestrial planets were made. And we use this as a reference point for what we think the Earth is like inside, because we can't actually see down that far. Now inside here there are a number of objects. You can see these funny irregular things. These are the oldest objects in the solar system that formed in the solar system, and I'll come back to those in a minute. They formed at very, very high temperatures, thousands of degrees. And they give us the oldest ages of anything in the solar system. And then you've got these round things that are sort of spherical, like droplets. And these can be shown to be little droplets of beads of what was molten material, formed at fantastically high temperatures. And we don't know quite how that happened, but they formed a little bit later, somewhere in the disk. And then there's stuff in here that you can't see, but which, if you dissolve all that rock, you're left with some stuff that doesn't dissolve very easily. And these things are grains of stuff that formed in the envelope of other stars. So this was only figured out about 20 years ago. People realized that when you dissolve these rocks, you had left behind some grains of things like graphite and silicon carbide and things like that. Silicon carbide doesn't form in normal silicate rocks on the surface of the Earth. And if you analyse the isotopic compositions of these things, that is, the kinds of different kinds of atoms of the elements you've got, they're nothing like the Earth at all. They formed around other stars. So in other words, we've got real stardust that you can actually put in your hand, effectively, except this stuff is submicron in size. And you can actually look at it under the microscope, stuff that is formed as another star. So for me, I mean, I find the moon fascinating, but actually I find the discovery of this stuff mind-blowing. It means that we can actually look at these things and figure out how stars work in a way that nobody knew we could do before. Now, if you look at the isotopic composition of a chondrite, a rock like the one I just showed you, you can measure the proportions of different isotopes, and you can come up with a composition that looks rather like it does in the Earth. Now, for those of you who don't know much about isotopes, this is an element called zirconium, but there are different kinds of atoms of zirconium, and they're different because they've got different numbers of neutrons. So because neutrons are neutral, they don't affect the chemistry, so it's all zirconium, but they're slightly different masses, they've got different numbers of neutrons. Okay, so this is zirconium 90, 91's got an extra neutron, 92's got two extra neutrons, etc. Now, the way in which these different isotopes are made tells you about the stars that they came from. And without going into any detail, this zirconium 96 is particularly difficult to make because you've got to make it from stuff that's lighter by adding neutrons. And the isotopes in between are unstable. So to get from, say, zirconium 94 to zirconium 96, you've got to hit zirconium 94 with two neutrons quickly before zirconium 95 decays away to get over to zirconium 96. So the only way we know how to make these things, or the most likely way, is if you've got a huge flux of neutrons, lots and lots of neutrons in stars. And the most likely environment for that is a supernova explosion. And we've got evidence that there was a supernova explosion shortly before the start of the solar system that produced these very, very heavy isotopes that we've got. So these are really important clues for how the solar system was formed, that there may have been a supernova trigger that caused collapse of the dust that actually caused the formation of the sun in the first place. Supernova, we're talking probably, the modelling that's been done of these things, the modelling suggests that you might have had something that was the size of 25 times the size of the sun, a huge star that exploded somewhere nearby and actually injected these nuclides. Now, what we do in the lab here in Oxford or in any of the places I've been before is we try and separate those elements out, whether it's zirconium or other elements. We separate them from those meteorites and rocks and lunar samples by dissolving them in nasty acids. We have to do it in very clean environments so that you don't contaminate the sample with any of the dust. So these are very expensive clean laboratories. The ones we've got here in Oxford are the most advanced in the world. They're fantastic. You basically have to dress up in all kinds of stuff to make sure you don't contaminate your sample. And then you have to use a technique called ion exchange chromatography to separate the zirconium from everything else in the laboratory. And then you can see this is our lab here in Oxford. This is one of our larger mass spectrometers here and from the Earth Sciences building. And we separate the isotopes out from each other and show what that proportion of different isotopes is using this thing that we call a mass spectrometer. That's all you need to know about mass spectrometry. And that tells us an awful lot about how the solar system formed. Now, some of those isotopes are radioactive, and you've all heard of radioactive isotopes. These are not radioactive isotopes that cause you any harm because they've got half-lives of millions of years. So, for example, if you take the element hafnium, these are the stable isotopes of hafnium. There's five of them here. This is tungsten. There's four here. There's actually a tungsten 180, but it's very small in abundance. Now, that's the way hafnium and tungsten look today. That's the different isotopes. But at the start of the solar system, there was another isotope around, hafnium 182. You can see that it's two masses higher than hafnium 180. So it required some kind of a supernova to give the neutrons to actually generate enough hafnium 182. So the discovery of hafnium 182 means that there must have been a supernova around at the time at the start of the solar system when for this stuff still to survive. And the reason we know it was there is because it decays over half-lives, with a half-life of 9 million years, or over tens of millions of years, to produce tungsten 182. So the solar system is 4.5 billion years old, so there's no hafnium 182 left on Earth today, but at the start of the solar system, this stuff was around, and it produced small changes in the amount of tungsten 182 that you see in tungsten. And we can measure that with these mass spectrometers. And it tells you about how much time was elapsed between the formation of objects in the early solar system. And that's how we figure out the time scales for how the planets formed. And this is roughly what it looks like. So this is a scale of 0 to roughly 90 million years from the start of the solar system. I just said these earliest objects in the solar system are these things that have been dated by uranium lead dating and another short-lived nuclide here. Don't worry about the details of this. But this shows you how precisely we know the start of the solar system. We know it to within less than a million. Sorry, GA is giga years, so it's a billion years, 1,000 million years. Okay, so we know this age of the solar system to within less than a million years, even though it was 4.5 billion years ago. So that's how precise we can do this these days. This is what these objects look like. They're sort of irregular things don't look at all interesting. Actually, they're the first things that we can actually analyse that we've been able to find that fall within the solar system. Now, the most common kind of meteorite that you find and you see in all the meteorite collections in museums are big chunks of iron. And very often they've got this interesting structure which is caused by exsolution of iron and nickel as they cooled. But they're very obviously meteorites because you don't get anything like this forming on Earth very easily. And if you measure the tungsten in these things, you can figure out that actually these iron meteorites, which are thought to be the remains of the cores of other planetary objects, in other words, small asteroids that melted, formed a core, and then got broken up. These things give you an age that's about 1 million years, or maybe 2 million years in some cases, younger than the star of the solar system. So we know that we're already forming small planetary objects within a couple of 1 million years. And these things probably extend up to things that are about the size of the moon in size. We've also got samples of Martian meteorites. We're very certain these meteorites come from Mars. There's over 50 of these things now. But we've analysed these things as well. They also give ages of about 1 million years. So Mars formed really fast. It accreted very, very quickly, differentiated and formed a core very, very fast. Those funny round things that we find in chondrites, those melt droplets, we've been able to date those as well. They seem to have, a lot of them seem to have formed about 2 million years after the star of the solar system. Some people think they formed from a pressure wave in the disk being caused by the growth of Jupiter very suddenly, creating a lot of heat frictional heat. But that's another detail you don't need. Now, there's another way that you can actually get at the age of the planets, and that's actually by looking at some of the moons of Saturn, which one of them has melted, and it hasn't quite melted, and its composition suggests it should have melted if there was this nuclide aluminium 26 around, which would have generated a lot of heat. And so modelling that tells you the time of the age of Iapetus, and that is the moon of Saturn, and that basically gives you an age of about 4 or 5 million years. So we think we didn't just grow these early terrestrial objects quickly, like Mars and the asteroids. We also grew the giant planets very, very quickly, in a few 1 million years. And that's consistent with what we saw in those images from the Orion Nebula and other places, those dusty disks. They're all gone within a few 1 million years. So that dust has gone to form planets, and that's consistent with what we find in terms of dating our own solar system. So now we come to the moon. And we have samples of the moon, including that lunar anorthosite, but a whole load of other samples as well, thanks to those Apollo astronauts. And if you date the moon using the same techniques, it's over here. So the earliest, using hafnium tungsten, it can form is about 30 million years. Other techniques give it an age of about 90 million years. So it's probably formed 90, 100 million years after the start of the solar system, much, much later than everything else. And it's an object that's about the size of, you know, some of these objects somewhere between Mars and, it's a lot smaller than Mars, probably the parent bodies of these magmatic iron meteorites. So an object that size, according to all our models, should form really, really early back here. And actually it formed very, very late. And that immediately gives you a class of models for how the moon could have formed, which are consistent with some and inconsistent with others. So let's talk about the various ways in which the moon could have formed and what people have said about it. So the first person here, the first hero, is George Darwin. George Darwin was the son of Charles Darwin, and he was a very eminent scientist, and he was a physicist, and he had this idea that actually the Earth was spinning, was at one stage a fiery, hot, fiery ball. It was spinning really, really fast with a period of a few days, a few hours. And it was able to release the moon from a sort of bulge of material that went into orbit around the Earth. George Darwin's ideas of fission have been thrown out for a variety of reasons. One is that as that material starts to lift off the surface of the Earth, you get tidal forces affecting it, which we know what the tides are today as a result of the moon, which is roughly 380,000 kilometres away. You know, but the tidal forces when you've got a moon right close to the Earth are huge, and they cause massive melting and all the rest of it, and they would fragment any object that tried to lift off the surface until it got to about 10,000 kilometres away, and then it would be too late. You know, by that time it would have been completely disrupted. So people said this can't possibly work. You can't actually get a physical body to lift off and stay intact like that. And the idea was largely discredited. But the nice thing about this model, relative to what we've just heard, is that it involves the moon forming quite late on, after you've already formed the Earth. And actually, so that's consistent with the ages we get. The other thing is, we said at the beginning, the moon is slightly depleted in iron. It doesn't have an iron core, or much of an iron core, so it's a relatively low-density object. And that would be consistent with it coming out from the outside of the Earth. Now, this theory was still knocking around as an idea when I was a kid and learning geology in the 60s. And I remember reading a book and actually said that, you know, the moon came out of the Pacific Ocean. Of course, nowadays, since then, we've figured out that the age of the Pacific Ocean is only a maximum of 200 million years. And so we know that that didn't exist in those times. But people knocked that idea around quite a while. So another model that was proposed was this guy, Thomas Jefferson Jackson See, who was a quite famous astronomer who eventually got heavily discredited and thrown out. He was working at the Lovell Observatory, and for reasons I don't need to go into, people said that he made up some of the results and stuff like that. You know. Anyway, so basically he ended up being totally thrown out from the scientific world. But he had the idea that actually you formed the moon just side by side. He had the idea that you basically formed it from something like a ring system, rather like Saturn's rings, that eventually just condensed or co-accreted to form the moon. The difficulty with this model is it doesn't really explain why the moon is spinning around the Earth and why that should be the case. It also doesn't really explain the age difference. Why does, you know, if the moon forms, why does the moon form 100 million years after this object here? And it also doesn't explain the density difference. This stuff you'd expect to be roughly the same composition, and it isn't. So that model's been pretty much thrown out, like he was, actually. And then there's a really distinguished scientist, Nobel Prize winner Harold Urey, who Harold Urey won the Nobel Prize for discovering deuterium, the isotope of hydrogen. He was a truly astonishing individual in terms of a brilliant mind who turned himself, his mind to all kinds of different things. He worked on loads of things to do with the origin of life and things like that in the early 50s. He's very famous for some of the experiments that were done on that around amino acids. He also worked on the origin of the moon, wrote a book about where the moon came from pretty much and the origin of the planets. And I was lucky enough to hear him lecture when I was a student at Newcastle in the early 70s. Very distinguished guy. He had the idea that basically the moon, you had to come up with this motion, and so the most likely way of doing this was to have the moon incorporated by capture into the Earth's orbit. One of the problems with this is actually the moon is actually moving away from the Earth. It's not moving in towards the Earth. And the other problem you've got with it is that it doesn't really explain why the moon is so late. This should be an early object that formed at the start of the solar system like everything else. Why is it so late with this model? So capture's been thrown out pretty much exclusively. But there are some other reasons why capture doesn't work now. We've got some samples back, and I'll come on to those in a minute. In the mid-1940s, this very famous geologist, Reginald Daly, published a paper on the origin of the moon and its topography. And he noticed that there was all this cratering and all the rest of it. He proposed that actually the moon itself formed as a result of an impact. And nobody took much notice of this. And later on, the ideas of the giant impact origin of the moon came out, and people more recently have rediscovered this paper, where he actually proposed something rather like that, although it wasn't figured out with any detailed modelling, of course, in those days. But it was an idea that basically the moon was formed as a result of a collision of the Earth with another smaller planet. Now, a number of other people, in particular Hartmann and Davis, proposed this in detail in the late 70s, and then some really early work was done by a famous astrophysicist called Al Cameron and his colleague Willie Benz, and they came up with the first computer models to show that you could actually make this work. And that came out of a conference in 1984 in Hawaii, which was one of the most exciting conferences in planetary sciences, where people got together to try and figure out how the moon could form, because none of the models seemed to work. And they brought all the bits of evidence. By that time, they had samples from the moon. They knew a bit about the age of the moon, but they also knew things about the composition of the moon, that I'll talk about in a minute, which made it clear that there had to be some other kind of model. So this giant impact theory basically came out of that, and it's been knocked around in a variety of ways, excuse the phrase. It's been knocked around in a few ways since then, and there's some lots of exciting new models that have come out, partly because the models don't work, and that's what I want to finish off with today. Is I'm afraid to tell you that we don't know how the moon formed. So, the idea of this model is that the Earth was struck with a glancing blow by another planet that was about 1/10 of the mass of the Earth. So it was when the Earth was about 90% of its current mass. Another body, about 10% of the mass of the Earth, came in, added that final 10% to the Earth. But some of the debris that from that collision ended up being thrown into orbit around the Earth, and that coalesced to form the Moon. You need the glancing blow to get the motion of the Moon around the Earth. You need the glancing blow also to skim off stuff from the outer portion of the Earth so that you end up with an object that's got relatively low density. You don't want to actually get all that iron metal in there, otherwise the Moon will end up being the wrong density. So there are a number of things that work from this. The other nice thing about this is it explains, this is a hugely energetic event. So we normally think of things like objects that wiped out the dinosaurs. So a meteorite the size of about 10 kilometers is thought to have wiped out the dinosaurs. This thing was a huge object that would have actually been half the diameter of the Earth, and it would have completely melted the planet. It would have vaporized some of the rock. You had a rock vapor atmosphere around the Earth after this. So the impact of this was absolutely huge, and the material that coalesced to form the moon would have condensed from a hot vapor. So it would have been silicate rock condensing from hot vapor. And that would explain why the moon would have had this start with this very fiery start, molten, with forming these crystals that we see on the surface of the moon, the white stuff, the lunar and orthosite I showed you at the beginning. Those crystals are low density, they tend to float towards the surface, so this big moon would have been a volcano. The whole moon would have been a volcano with crystals floating towards the surface, which gives you the white crust of the moon that you see today. So it's a great theory, fantastic idea, doesn't work. Okay, I'll come on to that now. Theia. So you had to come up with a name for this planet. So having worked on this for a while, I asked one of my colleagues who was the mother of Selene, the goddess of the moon. And so the mother of Selene, the goddess of the moon, is Theia. And here you see her. So just in case you're wondering where the name Theia came from, it came from the mother of Selene. And it was my colleague, Ryan Avila, who told me. So he's the person who originally got the credit. Now, I just want to quickly show you a simulation. Unfortunately, I just discovered a new version of PowerPoint that doesn't work. So I'm going to show you a simulation using nipping outside a minute, if I can get it all right. Okay. So this simulation basically shows you these two objects. It's a computer simulation that divides up the Earth and Theia into lots and lots of small pieces. And it looks at the physics of what happens when these pieces interact with each other and collide with each other. And just to bear in mind that to make a supercomputer do this simulation, each piece has got to be about the size of Paris or London. So on the scale of the Earth, there are lots of these pieces, but the Earth is so big that it's quite hard to do it. And just to give you an idea, everything looks blue to start off with, these two planets. Blue is 2,000 degrees. Red is 9,000 degrees, I think, somewhere like that. So this will give you a quick idea of... Sorry to do this in such a dysfunctional fashion. There we go. So, did you catch that?
Yes.
So anyway, these two planets collide. This is a 3D simulation from my colleague Robin Canuck. She's at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. This was achieved about 10 years ago. They did this. They've done more advanced simulations since then. It's quite nice, because it shows you how hot things get very quickly. And if you go back to the beginning, what you can see is that the surface. Let's go back to the beginning. That surface immediately goes up to 7,000, 9,000 degrees, whatever it is. What you can also see is the stuff sort of wraps itself around, forms this debris all around, and there's a trail of stuff that keeps recolliding with the Earth, and then more stuff getting spun out. And this goes on and on and on, eventually forms a disk. Now, if you do more detailed simulations of this kind of a process, let's switch this guy off. So you've got the idea, it's hot. If you go to more detailed simulations of this process, then what you find is that you can actually trace the various particles that are involved. Okay, so this is just the start of another simulation. Here are the two planets. Here's Earth, and here's Theia colliding. So the silicate portion of the Earth is green. The core is grey. This is the silicate portion of Theia in yellow, and the core is grey. So I want you to see what happens. We can probably do the lights further down, but I don't think you can do that. But anyway, basically, what you want to see what happens to the yellow and the green as this simulation goes on, because this shows you what actually happens to those. Oh, very good. This shows you what happens to those particular particles as you go around. And what you can see is that a lot of the grey mixes with the grey quite quickly. The yellow, which is from Theia, starts to wrap itself around the surface of the Earth. And the interior of the Earth stays pretty green, but there's a lot of yellow on the outside here. And this thing carries on, so this is in hours here, this thing carries on, and eventually you form a disk from which the moon forms. This doesn't show you how the moon forms, it just shows the disk forming. And it's dominated by the yellow, and there's not so much green in it. Now, that tells you that basically, if you do a dynamic simulation like this, it looks like when you form the moon, most of the stuff that ends up in the moon comes out of Theia, the yellow. The disk basically ends up being dominated by that yellow stuff, the stuff from the other planet. And here's the problem with the theory. I talked to you about isotopes. This is going to be even more complicated for you. Here's two different kinds of isotopes, oxygen 17 to 16 ratio, and this is the oxygen 18 to 16 ratio. Oxygen is the most diverse element in the solar system in terms of its isotopic composition. It's quite exciting for people like me, I can tell. Anyway, so don't worry about where we are in here. These are different kinds of meteorites in here. And basically, the key thing is that everything that lies in the solar system in terms of meteorites scatters all around this area. Everything that lies on the Earth lies along this line we call the terrestrial fractionation line. I'm going to zoom in on that right away. So when we look at samples from Mars, they lie over here. When we look at samples from what we thought to come from asteroid 4 Vesta, they lie over here. Nothing lies on this line that everything on Earth lies on, the terrestrial fractionation line, except these samples from the Moon. So this is a suite of over 20 samples from the Moon. Everyone looks exactly like the Earth. Whereas everything else we analyze in meteorites from the rest of the solar system looks different from the Earth. So there's a problem. How do you actually end up with the Moon looking like the Earth when actually the atoms are supposed to have come from this other planet? So this has been repeated with other kinds of elements. Initially, people thought that you could explain this just by some kind of mixing. So the Moon, you've got this hot magma ocean that the Earth is forming from, and you've got this disk from which this is the magma ocean on the Earth, this is the disk from which the Moon forms, and you have enough time for diffusion to mix up oxygen between these different regions before it all cools down. But then people found that, again, don't worry about the details, people found the same thing is true for titanium, which is a very refractory element. So these are very small variations in units of 0.01% of selenium-50. And again, this is the Earth. It's by definition zero. That's the blue points there. All the meteorites we get landing on Earth are completely different, but the Moon is identical. So we don't know how to explain that unless the atoms that are in the Moon came out of the Earth. Now, there's one explanation that people have considered is that the Theia, this other planet, was actually just circulating at around the same distance as the Earth, so it was made of the same stuff. And so the atoms, you know, the isotopic compositions were roughly the same, so you can't really tell one from the other. And Theia basically collided, generated this data, but the data looked like the Earth because actually Theia looked like the Earth, because it was about the same distance. But the difficulty with that model is you don't know quite why you'd have two planets going around the Sun at about the same distance from the Sun, in orbit around the Sun, without them colliding for 90 million years. There's no obvious reason how that would work. But there's another more powerful piece of work which was done since we've been at Oxford, and that's based on silicon, and that suggests that the atoms very definitely did come out of the Earth itself, and not out of Theia. And this is a bit more technical. I've nearly finished with the technical stuff. This guy, Francis Birch, who was a professor at the University of Chicago, in the 1950s, he showed that the core of the Earth had the wrong density to be made of pure iron. And he used this using the seismology. He could show to see how big the core of the Earth was, figured out how quickly the waves, earthquake waves went through there, and he figured out that can't be pure iron. It's got to have something else in there. And he theorized that there had to be some other light element in there. And for the last 60 years, everyone's been trying to figure out what that light element is. There's been hydrogen, nitrogen, carbon, sulfur, oxygen, and silicon. And silicon is one of the ones that people have considered as a possibility. And one of the reasons they've considered it could be a possibility is because if you compare those primitive meteorites that we say the planets are made of, and you take out the volatiles and the metals, and that's what the composition looks like. Compare that with what the silicate Earth is made of, like the Earth's mantle and crust, when you combine them, you can see there's a difference in silicon. There's a deficiency of silicon in the silicate Earth. People have thought maybe some silicon has gone into the core, which can happen. Silicon can behave as a metal in very reducing conditions. So in 2007, we published this paper in Nature, basically showing that indeed there's an isotopic fractionation which you can see in silicon in the Earth compared with other objects in the solar system that suggests that that's what's happened. So let me explain isotopic fractionation. So previously I've talked to you about variations to do with nuclear synthesis. I've talked to you about radioactive decay. But actually just the difference in mass between these different isotopes can actually mean that you get a shift in light to heavy. This is how we figure out the temperature of the oceans back through time. In paleoclimate, it's the amount of the oxygen isotopic composition of carbonate shells is temperature dependent, and it fractionates depending on the temperature. So an element will change from something like this to something like this to something like this. Gradually things will get heavier or lighter depending on what's happening. Same when you evaporate water, you change the oxygen isotopic composition, the hydrogen isotopic composition very slightly. Well, the same thing happens with silicon. Don't worry again about the details. Here's silicon. This is heavy silicon this way, light silicon this way. This is the silica content. Don't worry about that either. These are all the meteorites we've analyzed. Everything plots down here with this composition, and including samples from Mars and samples from the asteroid 4 Vesta. In other words, samples that have got cores, which we don't think have any silicon in. But if you analyze samples from the Earth, they plot up here. They're heavy. In other words, the mantle of the Earth and the crust of the Earth has got heavier silicon than average solar system, which suggests some of the silicon has gone into the core. And the only reason why that would happen is probably because the Earth is not just reducing, but also very high pressure and high temperature core formation. And that will actually, people have done experimental simulations, and that will get silicon to go into the core. So you wouldn't expect that for a small object. You don't see it on Mars, but you do see it on the silicate Earth. But you also see it in the Moon. So these are the lunar samples, and they're exactly the same as the Earth. And the only reason why they can be the same as the Earth is not because the atoms formed in the same area of the solar system. It has to mean they came out of this high, this silicate mantle of the Earth that actually had been fractionated by that core formation process. We have no other explanation for that. So it actually tells you it was this Earth itself that put those atoms into the Moon. How it happened is another question. So, back to our question about Othello. Is the very era of the Moon. She comes more near the Earth than she was wont and makes men mad. And actually, really, I should have said this, comes more near the Earth in isotopic composition than she was wont and makes scientists mad. And written by William Shakespeare and others. So, this is the standard impactor model I just showed you. It shows an Earth that's about 90% formed, and the Moon, an impacting planet that's about 10%. People have tried to see if they can use this kind of model to generate a Moon that actually has most of the material coming out of the Earth. There is one successful simulation of that that came out from the Swiss group in 2012. Called a hit-and-run collision, where most of the material from the impactor and the Earth, a lot of the material from the Earth as well, gets thrown away, but you can end up with some debris going into orbit around the Earth. The more interesting ones are these simulations, which came out in 2012 as well, which make a lot more sense in terms of the way we think the Earth formed. This is an impact. This is Robin Canup with those earlier simulations. She has an impactor that's about the same size as the Earth, and there's two planets colliding with almost the same size. And this simulation, which ironically is completely opposite, it has a tiny impact on the Earth at 2% of the mass of the Earth. And these two models are very different in terms of the way they work, but they both have one thing in common, and that is that they don't try and explain the spin of the Earth and the Moon with the collision. Instead, you have a head-to-head collision between the two planets, and you explain the spin of the Earth with the theory that actually the Earth was already spinning very, very fast. So you remember that first model of Darwin, that we had a fast-spinning Earth? These latest models have the Earth spinning with a period of 2 hours. Okay, your day lasts 2 hours. Incredibly fast-spinning Earth, fast head-on collision, you generate stuff that goes into orbit, and you've already got the system spinning. And this shows you a simulation of what that looks like for one of these models. So it's the same thing, green and yellow. So it's because it's spinning so fast, it looks like a rugby ball. You flatten it, a pancake. So basically, you then look at it from the top, and this is what it looks like. Hope you can see it. So now we're looking to see what the disk is made of, whether it's made of green or yellow. And when you do these simulations, the yellow, pretty much most of it goes into the interior of the Earth. It's a head-on collision. The green ends up dominating the disk all around. And after a period of several hours, you actually end up with a disk that has pretty much entirely been 24 hours. You end up with something that's dominated by a moon-forming disk that's green. So this is the latest theory for the origin of the Moon. There's a problem with it. And that is that the Earth has to be spinning really, really fast for a period of a couple of hours to make this work. And nobody knows how to slow it down afterwards. This simulation, this impact, doesn't slow it down enough. And so they've had to invoke a new kind of tidal connection between the Sun, the Earth and the Moon that slows down the Earth afterwards. And the dynamicists are arguing like crazy about this. They say the chances of this are very, very small. And it's actually not so different from some of the arguments that were originally raised about Darwin's theory about fission, that actually, how do you actually get the whole thing from fragmenting and forming apart? This is actually stuff fragmenting, forming apart, going into the orbit. So it's almost like a fission model that actually has a head-on collision generating the stuff that goes out. And you've got to slow it all down afterwards. Now, there are a couple of other things just before finishing, apart from saying I really don't know the answer, that you should know that we also have to explain that we don't explain at the moment. Very, very quickly. One is that these are the meteorites I talked about now in terms of the ratio of volatile elements to elements that are refractory. Potassium to uranium in this case, rubidium to barium in this case, don't worry about it. But these things boil off at low temperatures. And these things, these elements, potassium and rubidium, boil off at low temperatures. Uranium and barium are refractory, they don't boil off. And if you look at how much volatile material there is, you can see that Earth and Mars are up here. The Moon is very, very depleted in volatiles. We've known that for a while. And the Moon is depleted in water and carbon and all that stuff. None of these simulations explain that. We don't know why that happens or how that happens. So there's more work to be done. If the atoms came out of the Earth, how come the planet doesn't look like the Earth? How come the Moon doesn't look like the Earth? The second thing is that in some ways, the Moon is more like the Earth than we thought. This is what I'm finishing with. This is a shot of Apollo 17. And you notice, if you look on the ground here, where they sampled a lot of soils, the ground looks kind of orange. And when you look at these samples, when you bring them back to the laboratory, you see that actually this is full of orange glass, like beads. This soil is full of tiny spherules of high-temperature basalt, very high-temperature basalt, that was fire fountain from very deep within the interior of the Moon quite late on. So this is a volcanic eruption, again, 3.5 billion years old, or something like that. But these glass beads are still surviving on the surface of the Moon. When you analyze them, you can find traces of water in them, which is really interesting. So this paper came out in Nature, and there's been a lot of other papers since then, arguing that actually the water content of this deep interior of the Moon, it isn't so different from the interior of the Earth, which is, we don't have the interior of the Earth very well either, actually, but this has thrown up in the air a whole lot of other issues about how well do we know the interior of the Moon, and is it possible that some of these volatiles that are missing from the surface of the Moon are actually stored deeper in the Moon. So lots more work to do. Let me just quickly finish with some conclusions in case you got lost on the way through. So the first thing is the main growth of planetary objects up to Mars size took place within a few million years of the star and solar system. The Moon formed much later, probably between about 70 and 150 million years. Oxygen, titanium, chromium, silicon, I didn't talk about tungsten isotopes, provide evidence that Theia formed close to Earth, or more likely, the Moon's atoms actually came from or mixed with those of the Earth. This is hard to reconcile with the current dynamic models. There is no explanation at the moment for how the Moon formed that is satisfactory. If the Moon came from Earth, then volatile elements were lost, but we do not know how. And surprisingly, there is evidence that the deep Moon is not so different from the deep Earth in terms of water content. So, thank you very much. Oh yeah, this is just to show you that actually, Peanuts, what's the name? Snoopy got there first. So.